RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
All right, here on RCR on Monday mornings, we're starting a new series, which will go for a bit of time, a multi-episode story on, well, money, a series on money. What is money? And if you've been listening in the last month or two, you would have heard us speaking with Joel Robinson of Radical Investments in Wellington. And we've had some good chats along the way about KiwiSaver, Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, etc. And we thought it would be a good idea. Money is talked about a lot at the moment, and there's some insecurity about what money will end up being. So it's probably a good idea to get our arms around this, talk with Joel, and we'll do this over multiple weeks to sort of work through the issues. Joel, thanks for coming on and contributing to this.
My pleasure, Paul. Great to be part of it.
Yeah, no, fantastic. As soon as I saw the title, What is Money, I thought of that George Harrison song, What is Life?
Maybe someone should make one about what is money.
Yeah, I don't know how, out there. I don't know how it'd work in the lyrics. But in a way, in a kind of way, money is, well, it's not total life, but it's a big part of it. Boy.
It is. Yeah, it has a huge touch point onto every area of life. And often in ways, in very indirect ways that we don't really understand or realize until things change with it. And then we realize how much of an impact it has.
It's like the oil or the grease that greases the wheels of everything, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it just has such an integral role to how things function. When I was thinking about the series, I thought it would be really important or really useful to, I guess, give a bit of background to why this is topical for me and why I think actually it's relevant for listeners too. In the world of like financial advice, especially in investment, there's this big focus around, you know, past returns don't guarantee future returns, right? I mean, virtually everyone's heard that statement regardless of whether you're in the investment world or not. It's very valid, very true. But what I've really thought about and noticed isn't talked about is that past currency doesn't guarantee future currency. So why do we assume that that's always going to be the case? So when you're thinking about returns, returns have to be denominated in something. You know, New Zealand dollars, US dollars, Australian dollars. Well, in New Zealand, obviously, we really talk about returns in terms of New Zealand dollars. But there is this assumption that the New Zealand dollar will always be as it has been. And if you change in currencies at any point in time, well, that has a huge impact on returns because, you know, you're no longer denominating in terms of one currency and denominating in terms of another. And then in January this year, which previously talked about on Money Talks, that there was these Bitcoin ETFs that were launched in the US, so Bitcoin exchange traded funds, which really opened the door for more investment into the world of Bitcoin from your kind of traditional money areas like your banks and traditional finance, even KiwiSaver, for example. And what I've found, or my business has found, is that through one of the KiwiSaver providers I work with, people have this ability to buy these Bitcoin ETFs within KiwiSaver. Now, initially, I had some huge assumptions about the kind of people that would be interested in it, be buying it. You know, mostly people in their 20s and 30s that work in tech. And everyone I've talked to in the world of finance seems to have that same assumption. But actually, what I've seen has been very different. Has been a huge range of ages across New Zealand and across all sorts of walks of life, all sorts of professions, literally just about you name it. Huge, huge variety, and really actually very little correlation with those that work in technical and like
interesting
tech, IT type work. Yeah. And so because of this huge interest that has been much in excess of what I thought it would be, it's really driven me to you know, read more and understand about Bitcoin, because, you know, why are so many people that are intelligent, well thought out, why are they interested in this? It's not just, you know, gamblers, who I think is many people's assumption of who those sorts of people
that
are.
That comes down to awareness, doesn't it?
Mm.
So more people are aware than you'd assume.
Yep. More people are aware of, what Bitcoin is and why we should be aware of it and why should we should have some understanding of it. And to get there really, and to get really a critical appraisal of Bitcoin, of what sort of function it offers and why it might be relevant, we really have to get to the heart of what is money. Because if we're talking about Bitcoin, actually you're kind of having a conversation that's multiple steps down the line. You really have to start back at what is money? What has money historically been? How have we gotten to where we are now with the currencies that we have now, and what's played out really over the last century that has been huge in shaping what we have now, and what might the future look like? Because I think there's a very real possibility that it could be Bitcoin. There's a lot of factors about what Bitcoin is that would make it potentially meet a lot of the key requirements that good money has. But I don't think it's a given. But I think it's something that people need to be aware of and understand, because it could present one of the most significant changes in modern history.
Yeah.
With similar huge ramifications, perhaps even greater than the adoption of the internet and how much that, you know, has changed face of life and business. So
you've got me thinking that technology sort of goes in lockstep with this, doesn't it? Because you mentioned 100 years ago, before the telegraph, let's say. And I'm assuming that's when money could be wired. That's where that sort of kind of opened up. Before that, you're talking about the history of money and there's banking and everything. I mean, from previous chats we've had on Money Talks, we were aware of how banking kind of started, and that was a secure place to put your precious things.
Yep.
But it wasn't necessarily based around investment, was it? It was just a storage.
Correct.
And I guess you paid a fee for the storage.
Yes.
And there was some trust element in there that you could redeem that when you turned
correct.
Up a year or two later after you'd sort of crossed the oceans on sailing ships.
Yep, exactly.
But the whole concept of investment and a return, when did that start to be something?
Well, I mean, basically in primitive forms of society, you have even some basic elements of understanding investment and return. If someone is growing food, they understand the basic concept of investment return. You know, you're buying seed, you have food seed, you're taking some of your crop, letting it turn to seed rather than harvesting it and eating it or trading it. You know, some of the earliest forms of money are barter. Then you have a concept of investment and return. There's a concept of, well, actually, I don't want to pull up everything out of the ground and have no seed to be able to grow more. I want some of this crop to turn to seed. You'd understand that as a gardener, Paul, as do I.
Well, sort of.
Somewhat. Most people these days, I guess, don't do too much of the harvesting seed and replanting. You often go to, you know, Mitre 10 or Bunnings and buy the seed there. But the producer of that seed obviously is growing crops for seed. So even basically pre-human records, you could argue there's an understanding of investment and return. It's been a concept integral to life.
But when it was anchored to actual money or currency, that sort of narrows the scope, doesn't it? Because some people still do what you just said. That's the way they make their living, and they have to invest in you know, what they need to make that living. But really now, mostly we're talking about investment in terms of your money being given to another entity. They use it, they pay you for the use of it, and also an increasing value from whatever they're using it for. Some of that benefit comes back to you. That can only be done through currency or money now, right?
Yeah, through having some form of money, of currency. And I think to really unpack what money is, it'd be really worth talking through some of those functions of money. Because if we're ever thinking about what the future of money might look like, well, yeah, we need to understand what sort of function money plays to critically appraise what could be future money. So it really starts with this thing of coincidence of wants, which is this kind of amorphous sounding term. But basically that is what gave rise to the history of barter. So back before we have, you know, we're talking really, you know, primitive societies here, there's no kind of form of money. You're growing tomatoes, I'm growing celery. You know, we trade one kilo of my tomatoes for two of your celery, whatever that ratio is.
The exchange rate. Yeah.
Exactly. there's some form of exchange, and in really simple societies or even in local communities. I know in New Zealand there are places where people basically do barter. They effectively, you know, trade their lemons for someone else's time or someone else's fruit or veg. A very simple form of transaction, but one that doesn't involve money because you're just trading directly one thing for another thing. But what you find is as society gets more and more advanced is you have so many different things that to try and work out the price of everything in relation to everything else is impossible. Like, you know, if I look in front of me, what's sitting on the desk here, I've got a wallet, I've got a keyboard, a phone, a laptop, two computer screens, got a webcam, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There's so many things here, and this is just only a small space. Go into the supermarket and you look at all the different items there to try and figure out everything's value in terms of everything else. I mean, it's you're talking crazy amount of time and
massive,
wasted. And that's because we've got such a complex society now compared to if we go maybe 2.5 millennia, 3 millennia ago, where there's far less capital goods, far less highly developed, highly specialized products that exist. And so, yeah, what you find is over time, as societies become more advanced, there is this need for something that forms a medium of exchange, which is really your primary function of money. And to do a good job of being a medium of exchange, there's three really important things. And these are the kind of things alongside having so many different items to be able to trade, why barter doesn't work well at large scale. But the three main areas that are really important for money to meet. So you've got scales, so the ability for it to be exchanged on a different scale. So like, for example, if someone was growing tomatoes, I love tomatoes. I planted a huge amount of them last year.
Okay,
but if you're wanting to trade your tomatoes for a car, you know, that's a lot of tomatoes, right?
Yeah,
you have to get
a load probably or more. Yeah.
And you run into the issue in a barter system where someone that's selling a car, they're not going to want a car's worth of tomatoes, right?
Yeah.
Unless, that's I don't know, making tomato juice or something.
Yeah. Though tomatoes aren't that cheap now, Joel.
No, they're not. They're not. But it's still a fair few kilos of tomatoes. Well, we're probably talking tons, actually.
Yeah, tons. Yeah.
So, like this, you know, the scalability is a key factor. You know, if you're wanting to sell your car for tomatoes, you know, on the other side of that trade, you don't want to buy a car's worth of tomatoes. You're probably wanting some tomatoes, some something else, et cetera, et cetera. And so you end up having to have multiple trades to try and work it all out. So scalability is important. The other thing is timeframe. So if even if you found someone that wanted to buy a car's worth of tomatoes for a car, the amount of time it might take you to accumulate those tomatoes, you know, the first ones are basically starting to perish. Yeah, they're going off because obviously tomatoes don't last forever. Maybe tin tomatoes is the solution. But so time frames are a really key factor for why barter doesn't work, you know, when you start to
get more scale. It's almost a real time thing, isn't it? Because you're dealing with probably more organic materials, right? Because it's at that base level. So, yeah,
correct.
The clock is always ticking against the product.
Well, that's a good reason why a lot of natural resources and materials don't particularly make great money, because they don't, you know, have that longevity. You know, many of them perish. It's why gold has formed a huge part of money for a lot of history, because it is so basically indestructible compared with many other metals, and especially with things like food, basically, why food is often not a good solution. The other thing that's important, talking about this coincidence of wants, is location. So if I'm the one selling the car and I'm in Auckland, and the person that's got tomatoes in Queenstown, obviously there's got to be some form of transport of that. That has a cost inherent to it, and that can create some barriers. And so because we're in such an interconnected world now where, you know, you're on Amazon buying a book from someone in Australia or the US, or you can think of tons of examples out there. That's why the larger and more interconnected, the more developed society gets, why barter can't be that main form of transaction leading to need for money.
Yeah, and money that everyone believes in, Because that's the other part of it, isn't it? We've all got to buy in.
That's very true, yeah. So that is, a key part of the function of money, or one of the functions it needs to meet. So there are three key functions of money, the first being that it's used as a medium of exchange. So when, like I've said, you know, when an economy gets larger, there is specialization that occurs. And so there needs to be some ability for that money to be able to be exchanged for other things. So some of those characteristics that are involved is that money doesn't inherently offer a return. So when anyone's thinking about, you know, Bitcoin at the moment, people constantly talk about, the movement of its value in terms of New Zealand dollars, which is why currently it's not a really good form of money, because it doesn't have, well, it's being bought and sold based on a form of return, but longer term money doesn't actually have a return in of itself and holding itself. You can invest it for a return, but that's a key difference. The second is it should be low risk. Currently, Bitcoin is not perceived to be low risk, and your typical fiat currencies like New Zealand dollar, Australian dollar, US dollar are seen as low risk. But that is also because it's tied in with one of the other functions of money, which is that, like you said, it's widely held, or a unit of account, get to. But really, I guess what kind of sums it up is, in a nutshell, choosing to acquire something not for its own sake, but for the express purpose of using it to buy something else. That's basically what money is. It's something that's held for having purchasing power. If you were to give someone to win, you know, win the lotto, you talk about with people winning the lotto and, what you'd do with the money. People don't actually want the money. They want the purchasing power.
And they're not thinking of you can gaze at the bank balance as long as you like, but if you're not doing anything with it, unless you're the Wellington mayor. Well, she didn't do that. She spent it all, I think.
The comments about struggling to live on $190,000 a year was interesting.
But that's actually quite a common story, that people flame through it pretty quick. Because of that, because you want to go out and buy everything that you've ever wanted, that you dreamed of, right?
Exactly. I mean, there's a lot of cases of people who have won the lotto both here and overseas and ended up worse off because they've just blown the money and they've had that pressure from family and friends of, you know, hey, share some of this love.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. People don't sit there and, you know, might sit there and stare at the bank account for a bit, but what people are thinking about is not, you know, $1 million or one with six zeros after it. They're thinking about, what does this buy? What's the purchasing power of this? Oh, I can go and do that holiday. Because, you know, immediately you talk about winning the lotto, people then start talking about what they do with it.
Yeah.
That's why people care about it. It's not because it's, you know, a love of the New Zealand dollar itself, it's what it will achieve. And often people can, because we think about, I want to do this thing, it costs this much New Zealand dollars, therefore my goal is collecting New Zealand dollars. Often we struggle to detach the two in our mind. And so when you start talking about the perspective or possibility of a change of currency that people do life in, people struggle to think about that because it's so intertwined. The currency that we do life in, especially if it's all we've ever known, which for every generation alive today, basically, is the case. But what the reality is, actually what we want is the purchasing power.
Yeah.
AKA, what can that money buy for me? We've just intertwined the two in our minds because it's easier to think about that way. But in reality, they're actually two separate things. You know, New Zealand dollar is the medium. People don't really actually care that much about the medium. They care about what the medium will essentially do for them. Yeah.
So something like Bitcoin, I was just thinking, if you won lotto, you should just go out and buy a huge amount of Bitcoin, right?
Well, you could. You could. I mean, I don't think the monetary transition to Bitcoin, which I do think, by the way, my default theory is that at some point Bitcoin will become the predominant, at least store of value in some way, shape or form. But I don't think it's a given. There are certainly risks that need to be addressed along the way that might prevent that from happening. So I wouldn't be someone that would be going out, if I won the lotto and putting it all into Bitcoin, but I certainly wouldn't be putting none.
Is it like, do we think of that as like a store, like gold is?
Yeah. So that is really, that's a key second, well, it's actually the second function of money, is that it needs to be a good store of value. Because if it's, if what you're using is not a good store of value, then people aren't going to want to hold it. And you know, go back to the example of tomatoes. Tomatoes are never going to be a good currency, ever, because okay. they perish.
I'll take your advice on that. Yeah,
I mean, great for eating, and you might be able to barter them with your neighbours. But you know, we're never going to see a case of tomatoes being the prominent world currency, obviously, because they just don't meet a lot of those key functions. So, yeah, it needs to be able to be stored well, and that storage, that store of value, is kind of two things. It's not just how like durable, how well, how long does that thing last for? It's how well does that thing hold its value over time? And they're actually two quite different things. Sometimes we detach a bit. Like if you look at metals, different metals, gold has held its value very well over time. In fact, it's increased relative to the value, or the purchasing power, I should say, rather than value, the purchasing power of New Zealand dollar, US dollar. Gold's done very well. But not every metal has. If we look at, for example, lithium prices over the last few years, as demand for electric vehicles has fallen, the price of lithium has plummeted. It's been a poor store of value the last 3 years. Mm. Nickel, the last 10 years, nickel has basically had zero movement. Well, there's been quite a bit of movement along the way, but from 10 years ago to today, the value of nickel has basically had a 0% change relative to the US dollar. All the while over that time frame, the actual purchasing power of the US dollar has fallen, as it has with New Zealand dollar and every fiat currency. Something can be durable, like nickel is very durable. It can last for decades, but it's not a great store of value, because the other part of store of value is not just durable, but something that holds its value well over time. So the argument is that Bitcoin, like with gold, is something that, in theory, longer term, will prove to be a reliable store of value, because one, it's durable, arguably indestructible, though there is some debate on that, which we will get to. That's probably a few chats down the line.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, gold is something that, you know, for example, has been very durable, and gold that was mined centuries ago, millennia ago even, most likely, we don't know for certain, but most likely gold that was mined millennia ago, or the first gold ever mined, still exists today. It's very, very hard to destroy.
There's also a cultural / emotional something connection to it, isn't it? Isn't there? Because, yep. I mean, you look back into the ancient Egyptians, you know, those huge burial chambers just dripping with gold, depending on who you were. Point I'm making is that it's also perceived as a very high-end representation of a status, right? So so that has kept it, I'm thinking, elevated through all this time. Yes. You know, if you want to make the ultimate statue to someone, I mean, look at the Oscars. I mean, it's not gold, but it looks gold. You know, it has that factor, which might traverse all the ups and downs and peaks and troughs. I mean, it's not like, you know, you're going to make a sarcophagus out of nickel.
No.
You know, if you're someone special, it's like, but, what, nickel?
Yeah.
You know, well, you know what I'm saying?
Exactly. Yeah, you're exactly right. And you're really hitting on it's kind of really back to the store of value side of things. It's because nickel, lithium, a lot of these things are actually quite, you know, easy to mine relative, especially to gold. And so if something's easy to mine and the price goes up, everyone wants to start mining it, because there's money to be made there. And you have the supply, if the ability of the new supply is able to be ramped up really quickly relative to the existing stock that's out there, then the price is just going to plummet. It's going to come back down to earth, because you get supply outweighs demand, classic supply and demand, economics 101, it's basically a natural law. If supply way outstrips the demand, then the price is going to come back down to earth in whatever form of money you're doing, whether it's US dollars or something else. Whereas with gold, historically, and I'll talk about it more in the second episode as we talk about some of the history of money, but basically gold has had what you call a really high stock to flow ratio. So I'll break that down. So stock being like the existing supply that's out there that's been mined, it's available. So all gold that's in existence, for example. And flow being like the new creation. You call it like, you can measure it annually, you can measure it two yearly, doesn't really matter. It's the rate of new supply. And any item, any object out there, any money that has a high stock to flow ratio, so aka stock that's out there relative to the new supply each year, if the relative stock that's out there is high relative to what's being newly created or added each year, then that thing is going to generally be a very good store of value, because it's very difficult to essentially have debasement or to have a reduction in the value of what you've got, because that supply is always, well, not always, but often struggling to keep up with demand.
Yep.
And yep. Gold is a good example of this, because it's quite expensive to get out of the earth. And even with advances in technology that we've seen over millennia, it hasn't really massively changed the ability to get new gold out of the earth. But additional to that is that all of that existing supply that's previously been mined still exists.
Yeah, because it never goes anywhere. It lasts probably yep. as long as the universe will last.
Very, very durable. So,
yeah. In other words, yeah.
Whereas things like nickel, lithium, not as durable.
Yeah.
You know, you get other forms of metals as well that are even less durable. I'm not a metals expert, I'll be honest. But those that are listening perhaps might know more. You know, there are plenty of metals out there that tarnish over time. Even silver has a shorter lifetime than gold. And so if that stock over time is actually diminishing, and there is the ability for that supply to rapidly increase and respond to changes in value, then that's something that's got a low stock to value, a low stock to value ratio. And another way to view high stock to flow and low stock to flow is hard money or easy money. So hard money being money, whatever that be. So in the past, gold coins, good example of hard money. It has a very high stock to flow ratio, very difficult to massively increase the supply of new gold coins. Whereas silver coins, although somewhat hard compared to some other types of metals, it's relatively easy compared to gold. So that's why gold coins and gold plated this has even, like you were alluding to, had some level of cultural relevance attached to it, because of those properties that it has. And you see that across a lot of countries, really. You know, obviously India is very well known for their affinity with gold, as well as much of the Middle East, and that comes interestingly back to history, even back to the Roman Empire, which we'll talk through in the next.
Oh, that'll be interesting.
Episode. Yeah. And their supply of money.
And again, the new form, talking about Bitcoin, kind of the same, isn't it? There's the ratios you're talking about.
Yes.
For a start, there's an intended cap. Hasn't been reached yet, but there will be. So once that's hit, no new Bitcoins.
Correct.
And it's difficult, again, they don't extract, but to generate, right? So it's not just your fingers and you've...
Correct.
You know, the PC works overnight and you've got a million Bitcoins. It doesn't work like that. So it's very similar, isn't it?
Yes. Well, that's part of why there's a belief that Bitcoin can form the future of money, is because it has a very high stock to flow ratio, like with gold. So the existing supply, in theory, should last forever as long as the network continues to run.
Well, that's we'll get to that. Where it differs from gold.
Yeah. Well, it is. Yeah, it is a big difference to gold. Gold's not inherently digital. It's the physical tangibility to it, which is another reason.
Unless it's a virtual reality we're living in, Joel, but that's for another series. But as far as we're concerned, it's a physical thing. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. And so, yes, you're right. Bitcoin, there's a hard cap of 21 million Bitcoin that can ever exist. And we're currently at, I think it's somewhere in the 19 million range.
Yeah, not far to go.
Thereabouts.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, one of the interesting characteristics is every effectively 4 years, we'll get to the detail on that. But effectively, every 4 years, the rate of new suppliers, the flow, halves.
Okay. Yeah.
Because it gets twice as difficult to mine or to create.
Yeah.
And so the argument being that the creation rate, no matter how much effort is put into the new creation, no matter how much resources expended on that new creation, that supply rate is basically unable to be changed. And why
does that mean does that mean the last Bitcoin ever created takes forever?
No. Well, relative for us, it probably feels like it takes forever because the forecast is that it will be mined in the year 2140. So
okay, yeah, that's a way
no,
off.
No yeah. one, probably no one listening to this. Well, who knows, actually? I won't say no one because we don't know what's going to happen in terms of health, and we don't know, you know, maybe this podcast will be listened to in 40 years by someone reflecting on, you know, these idiots who 40 years ago who didn't know anything.
Doing a bit of research on how it used to be. But
yeah, how life used to be, exactly.
Yeah,
yeah, so, yeah, no one listening to this in the year 2024, we'll say, or 2025 probably will be alive to see the mining of that last Bitcoin, or very few. But, yeah, as we get further and further into the future, that supply, the increase in supply diminishes at a greater rate.
Yeah.
Makes it tough.
It's fascinating.
Mm.
Well, that was a good walkthrough for the first in our series of What is Money? With you, Joel. And
thanks, Paul.
So we'll go a whole lot of places between now and when we're done. We've got six major topics. One might be broken into two. See how we go. But by the end of it, if you don't know what money is, there's nothing I will be able to suggest, put it that way.
Yeah, I've failed at my job.
No, I'm sure you won't do that. Hey, thanks, Joel. That was really interesting. And we'll talk again this time, around this time next Monday, okay?
Perfect. Thanks, Paul.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.